You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, a weekly series that brings you exclusive, in-depth conversations with some of the most interesting and exciting figures in hip-hop. We're brought to you by RapGenius.com, your source on the internet for decoding, annotating, and analyzing rap lyrics. I'm your host, Same Old Sean. This week, we talk to a man of many names. Derek Angeletti, also known as D-Dot, is a producer and rapper, best known for his time as a member of Bad Boy Records' production collective, The Hitmen. Angeletti produced such huge hits as Hypnotize, All About the Benjamins, Jay-Z's classic Where I'm From, and more, for artists like Biggie, Mace, 50 Cent, Busta Rhymes, Foxy Brown, Rakim, and others. As a rapper, Angeletti is best known for his angry alter ego, The Mad Rapper. The Mad Rapper, who made his first appearance on a skit on Biggie's Life After Death album, has gone on to release albums and mixtapes of his own, some in tandem with his brother, the Mad Producer, and provide a hilarious counterpoint to rap's high life boasting with his angry monologues. But before all that, Angeletti had a hugely interesting and much lesser known phase. He began his career in a duo called Two Kings in a Cypher, with future Hitman partner Ron Lawrence, rapping under the name DOP, or Deliverer of Prophecy. The group put out an amazing record in 1991 called From Pyramids to Projects, which was steeped in the Afrocentricity popular at the time, but also had an incredible diversity and humor lacking from so much of the conscious music of the era. We began our interview by asking Angeletti about his relationship to the 5% Nation of Islam, whose doctrines heavily influenced the lyrics of his first group. Outside the Lines with Up Genius here with Derek Angeletti, a.k.a. D-Dot, a.k.a. Mad Rapper, a.k.a. the Mad Producer.
Right.
So we've got three interviews for the price of one today.
Exactly. Oh, let's do this, son. Come on, let's get this going.
Unbelievable. So I wanted to talk. Take it back. We were talking before off camera about Two Kings in a Cypher, your very first group with Ron Lawrence. You were maybe 21.
I was 21 when I started.
21 you started.
23 when we came out.
Yeah. That group, I think, will surprise people who haven't heard it. Should definitely check it out. The album's great. Mm-hmm. And I think it will surprise a lot of people who are familiar with your other work, because there's a very heavy sort of conscious element to it.
Right.
Very influenced by the sort of philosophies of the 5% Nation of Islam.
Definitely.
And so I was curious about that. Can you talk about when you first encountered the 5% Nation and why their ideas appealed to you, maybe?
Definitely. Well, I first encountered the 5% Nation as a teenager in Brooklyn growing up. Mm-hmm. In the 70s and 80s, 5% was a growing faction. They actually were offshoot of the Nation of Islam.
Right.
The person who started, his name was Clarence 13X. I guess he didn't agree with certain things that the Nation of Islam was doing, so he decided to do whatever, start his 5% Nation, and he took some lessons and Supreme Alphabet and Supreme Mathematics and things like that and developed the 5% Nation. So throughout New York City and around the country, you had guys changing their names from, you know, Arthur Johnson to Supreme Allah Magnetic, or, you know, Justice whatever, you know.
Yeah.
And so obviously, I was the only child, and growing up in Brooklyn, it fascinated me. I liked, it looked like from the outside in, they were organized. It looked like they were positive for black people. It looked like some of the young men would change some of their ways and go on to do positive things. So it was attractive. So at 14, 12, 13 years old, you start studying lessons. You start getting your enlightener to come and teach you supreme math, supreme alphabet.
Because stuff's not written down, right? You have to find someone already and to sort of instruct
somebody,
you.
Somebody, most likely your enlightener, whoever introduces you, already has the lessons written down. They're all written down.
Oh, okay.
They give them to you to study, and then you have to study them. It's just like a test. Remove them when it's time for the test, and then there were things called bombing or universal beatdowns where you would meet other gods and earths, and they would test your knowledge of the lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And you would let them know what stage of the lessons you were in, whether you were at the beginning, whether you were in the middle. And if depending on what you said, then they would test you based on what you said you knew.
Mm-hmm.
And if you got it wrong, or you didn't interpret it the right way, or it wasn't the universal understanding of it, you would get hurt, or you would get punished, or whatever the term would be.
Yeah.
And this was at a very young age. By the time I got to Howard University, I was no longer in the 5% nation because it wasn't what I thought it was going to be. And that's just my personal thought. Mm-hmm. Nothing bad about it, the nation itself. It's just that me, I went into it with expectations, and it didn't do that.
Can you talk a little bit about what you mean, by that?
Or? Well, you know, they were still smoking weed. There was guys still stealing, still robbing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the jails were filled with supreme mathematics and Allahs and all these guys who were committing murders and robbing. And that wasn't what the Nation of Islam was showing. The Nation of Islam was showing that after you come from jail, you better yourself. They're outside selling bean pies. They're dressing. They're shaving. They're cleaning up their face.
Right.
The Nation of Gods and Earths were more like, I self, Lord and Master. I rule my own cipher, so I can, if I want to wear a long beard, if I want to be a hustler, if I want to sell drugs, I'm my own God. They justified it by saying that, and that wasn't where my head was at. And in one incident, my enlightener, quote unquote, I allowed him to come into my home, and he ended up robbing my home. Not while I was there, you know, set us up for a robbery.
Sure.
So that at that point, I realized this is not where I want to be. But the lessons themselves, there were things in the lessons that still stick with me to this day. And so I held on to those lessons because I was a pretty good student at the time.
Yeah.
So I held on to those lessons. So by the time I got to Howard University, which was a more universal black thought thinking university, it wasn't Muslim, it wasn't Buddhism, it wasn't Christianity. It was just a way of black thinking, so to speak. We use some of those lessons to further our advancement at Howard University. And Ron also, who's older than me,
right,
he didn't go right from high school to college. So when he got to Howard, he was already 3 years older than me. He was also in the 5% nation.
Yeah.
And he had his own experiences with it, but he wasn't actively studying it. But we felt like some of the lessons from there applied to our lives at the time. And with our new introduction to the Nation of Islam, with our manager, Haq Islam, who ended up becoming a manager and discovering Maya and Drew Hill, things like that in the music business, he was very closely associated with the minister, Farrakhan. He was actually a junior, a junior minister.
Mm-hmm.
So combined with his exposure, giving us the exposure to the Nation of Islam, combining that with our Howard University experiences, with our street knowledge, and then 5% nation, it all came to a nice build-up for us to say, okay, why don't we just take all of those things, and Two Kings and a Cypher will be what it is. And if you noticed in Two Kings and a Cypher, Ron would have on the more authentic Egyptian representation, and I represented the new way it was, where it wasn't necessarily the garb, it was what was up in here.
Yeah.
And that's what you saw.
It's so interesting you talk about all the influences on the TKO record, because one of the things for me that differentiates it from other conscious records of the time is that it's more diverse. There's, you know, there's the funny song, there's the kind of bragging and battle songs, right, and then there's the more conscious ones and whatever.
We have records like So What I Can Dance.
Yeah.
Right. Was just, you know, Ron couldn't dance.
Right.
But he was making the beats, and I used to find that funny that he would make these hot ass beats. But he wasn't the, he wouldn't move like I move. But his beats were, you know, so we you know, those are things, and we incorporated all our real life stuff into what we did. And I didn't want to be a conscious rapper, so to speak. I was from Brooklyn, New York, and I was influenced by LL and KRS and Big Daddy Kane. So I wanted to rap about regular street stuff, mm-hmm. but I also felt like I'm privileged to go to Howard University. I should have something more to say than just, yo, I'm that guy and let's do this. And so I felt a little obligation to kind of fill, put some knowledge of my experiences because I was blessed to have this knowledge.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, if I can balance it and do D-Dot or D.O.P. at the time, if I could do D.O.P. and yet give the kids a little bit of the real Derek Angeletti from mm-hmm. Brooklyn that went to Tilden High School, the street guy and who had a Puerto Rican mother and things like that, yeah let me do that.
Awesome. You brought up So What I Can't Dance, and yeah. I wanted to talk about that record for a second because okay. it's like, it's to me it's like a bridge between the TKO stuff and the Mad Rapper, because
Definitely. It's
funny and self-depreciating
Definitely.
in the way the Mad Rapper is.
Definitely.
When did you first realize you could be funny?
I was the class clown.
Yeah.
I have that problem with my daughter Alexis right now. She's the class clown. I was always the class clown. And it probably was because I was the only child, so I always had to entertain myself.
Mm-hmm.
So I was good at that. You could put me in a room by myself and I'll be just fine. You know, and like I said, I was influenced by the LLs, the Kanes, the Beastie Boys. Rap was funny. Dana Dane, you know, Slick Rick. Slick Rick was one of the funniest guys to me. When you meet him, you wouldn't think funny at all. But when you listen to him, this guy was 20 years ahead of his time.
Sure.
And, you know, G-Rap. We talked about G-Rap.
Yeah.
There was lines when you hear G-Rap that would crack you up. In his hardest state, he said something that was funny. Biggie was probably one of the funniest guys you ever want to meet.
Yeah.
So to me, it wasn't that much of a stretch
mm-hmm.
to be funny. And to me, it made listening better. Because if we just hit you with, you know, power to the black man, every verse, and the black man is this, and the white man is that, and you should do it. By song 4, you're like, you know
right.
what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And I didn't want to deliver anything like that.
Yeah.
I didn't want to deliver anything like that. And Ron was the same way, because Ron is a great spirit. So and he's not a serious, straight-up, all-the-time guy either. So we decided, and then we had a guy who was our third member. His name was Tone, the executioner.
The DJ.
He was a DJ. Yeah. And he wasn't into none of that. You know, no 5%, no Nation of Islam. He was from upstate New York. He drove a Jetta. He drank. He smoked weed. And, you know, he was like, listen, man, you know, for him, it was boring to be a part of that if that's all we're going to do. So we had to figure out a balance between the three. And I think So What I Can't Dance was, like you said, it was one of those records where we could let our head down.
Yeah.
This ain't got to be about lessons. It ain't got to be about God. This ain't got to be about everything is, you know, do the right thing. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah.
That's amazing. And the Mad Rapper character, that came out in response to the East Coast, West Coast beef,
yes.
right, as a way to send up this situation.
And also to let them know that we're brushing it off our shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going to entertain this bullshit. Like, this is not our style. We're not a group of thugs that just happen to get a record company. We are guys that want to win, make money, make people dance, and make history.
Mm-hmm.
If y'all ain't with that, then we can't even be on the same page. We can't even talk to you. And since I was the comedic outlet for a lot of people, I felt like, you know, I got it. Because none of them guys really scared me at all. Like, all that shit that was going on. I was like, listen, y'all know where I'm from? Let me take you to where I'm from. That shit you saying is laughable.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really where the Mad Rapper came from.
Where'd the voice come from?
Actually, you know what? On Biggie's album, the voice that I used later on wasn't the same voice. I pretty much was more of my regular voice on the original interlude
mm-hmm.
because it was all made up right then and there. Nothing was planned out. The people, the Shay from New Rochelle,
yeah,
she was the front desk girl. She wasn't from New Rochelle.
Right.
But her real name was Shay, and I just said, make up a name, where you from? Trevin Jones was the studio manager. He just had a very, you know, one of those voices. He's a black guy. When you meet him, you're like, really? And I just said, this is what I want you to say. You know, I wrote everybody's words and said, this is what I want you to say, and this is how I want you to say it. Hi, it was Trevin Jones, and I'm, you know, and it made people laugh, because now when you walk in the studio, now you don't look at Trevin the same way anymore. When you look at the front desk girl, you don't look at her the same way. Every time you walk in, people would just start doing that.
Yeah.
Start cracking up. Like, wow, you're Shay from New Rochelle? Why are you so mad? You know?
Right.
Right. I just used the beauty of what I do is I just use whatever's around me. Mm-hmm. There was no need to go out and find actors and actresses and all that shit. Just, mm-hmm. can you do it? Come on in the room.
That's awesome. Moving on, there was something that always kind of puzzled me. You had that line, you say, the only potholes on my lawn are from MCs that I killed. Did you have something against De La? Was there like a little
Not at
sort
all.
Of diss there? Okay.
Mm-hmm. I thought I was kind of using it in a positive way, but okay. I got that's you're the second person in 20 how long was that album?
20 years maybe?
20 years to ask me that question. And I was like, De La is one of my favorite groups of all time. I actually know them, I actually hang out with them. And mm-hmm. the guy who used to work for me, his name is Christopher Quinn Smiles. Mm-hmm. He's their manager now. So no, it wasn't.
Uh-huh.
But back then somebody asked me that, like maybe 15 years ago. Did you have a problem with De La? I was like, no, Powell's in my lawn. It was like, you know, I was trying to say that, you know, it's just, and I don't know what theirs actually meant back then. I had no clue what potholes in the lawn meant for them.
Right.
It was just, I have no potholes in my lawn.
Yeah. Can you just, one or two more things about that record, okay. like, on stuff like how you figure on that record, is really, like, it's really intricate rapping, right? You got, like, the multi-syllable stuff, and it's really kind of aggressive and really
That's where I wanted
really
to
good.
Show my thing.
Yeah.
Like, I needed to let people know that I can rap.
Yeah. And you haven't done, since that record, like, you've done some rapping as D-Dot, but not comparatively all that much. Why is that?
Good question. I actually had an offer to sign to Def Jam as a soloist after 2 Kings of Cypher, and I actually was scared, bottom line. I didn't want to be a soloist. I didn't like the pressure of it. I didn't like what I was seeing. I knew I could compete, but I didn't want to do that. So I creatively tried to figure out a way that I can do it on my own accord. And I never was really told that I was really good until after I decided not to rap. So while I was rapping, people were like, yeah, you're good, but they didn't like me in the concept of 2 Kings and a Cypher, so I never got the accolades that, you know, some of these other rappers who weren't as positive got.
Mm-hmm.
So when you rapping in a, you know, nobody's going to put the guy from Poor Righteous Teachers in their top 10, unfortunately.
Wise Intelligent,
unfortunately. And I think that's only because of the genre
yeah.
of music. But if you actually listen to his whole style and flows and everything, you're like, yo, this kid was actually really nice.
Yeah.
But when you're positive, you kind of get moved to the left a little bit. And
right.
that's kind of where I got moved. And I was like, then, well, how am I going to break back in the show LL and show these guys that I can compete with them on records? And it wasn't until years later that I actually wrote lyrics for other people that people were like, damn, D-Dot, you're kind of nice. Or when I actually ended up doing the Mad Rapper album and somebody like, what's Buster's right-hand man's name?
Spliffstar?
Spliffstar
yeah.
told Buster that he should go in and do his record over because D-Dot killed you. On we did a record called Bongo Break on
yeah.
the Mad Rapper album.
Yeah.
And that threw Buster off. Or me going into the thing saying, wow, Eminem just crushed me on my own record, but everybody else that he did records with didn't even come close to competing with him. So when Eminem came back to me, he was like, yo, man, a lot of people say you did your thing on that record. That's a good thing. And I was like, really? Like, wow.
Yeah.
Years later, this is years after 2 Kings of Cypher, I'm like, damn, I should have fucking became a soloist. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I should have fucking did that shit. But
now you're...
I didn't live to the credit. You
yeah.
know what I'm saying?
Yeah, definitely. So, when you were at Howard, right,
mm-hmm.
You met someone I think you know I'm going to ask about, circa 1987. You met Puffy then, right?
In 97?
87.
87, yes. Yeah.
At Howard. I was curious about this. Like, what was he like back then? How was he the same, and how is he different now? Like, is he still basically the same person?
Very much the same person then and now.
Yeah.
Always still wanted to be the center of attention, which was why we probably... And here's the crazy part. What I tell people all the time is why I have so much respect for him is because when he came on campus, I was considered the guy who was not supposed to be at Howard. I was smoking weed. I wasn't going to class. I was the DC guy, meaning I wasn't messing with nobody on Howard's campus. I was in the streets of D.C. I had D.C. girls. I was going to D.C. clubs. And I was the only one who had an off-campus apartment. So Puff, in his infinite wisdom, knew that he needed to attach himself to me to give him those extra cool points, because he was just cool with the freshman girls at Howard because he wore, you know, the big pants with the holes in them, and they put, remember they used to put ribbons in their shoes, and the big, remember the big shoes people used to wear? They used to have these big heels, they used to call them bump toe shoes or something. He was that guy. So when you know, you'd have a party, Puff be in the middle of the floor with everybody making circles, him and his boy be, Walt G, they be doing the dances, and I was the guy on the side puffing with the DJs and doing whatever. So he actually approached me one day, and he was very, he was futuristic. His mind was always thinking about how to get a hustle going on.
Yeah.
One story about him to show you how much he hasn't changed was, in 1988 or 89, Howard University, we had a guy named David Duke,
who was sitting on our board. Right, I remember who it was. Yeah,
he was. He was supposed to be on our board of directors, and we protested, and we ended up taking over the administration building. So students from many all
Wait,
over.
David Duke from Louisiana, the politician?
Yes.
Was
he was supposed to? They were trying to put him on Howard University's board of directors, and he was considered a Ku Klux Klan member.
Yeah.
Right. So that threw us off.
Of course.
So we protested and we took over the administration building. All right. So news cameras, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, everybody got to come now. So we took it over. We put chains on the buildings. And these two girls who were, you know, remember Howard is this rebellion power to the black people. So you got people that were with it. So these two girls, we took over the thing. They went on their own and found the communication system that the security all of Howard uses. So we can hear everything that they were planning to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we heard that they were planning on coming through the roof with helicopters, with tear gas, and they were going to come through the stairs of the roof and come get us out.
Yeah.
So we went up first, and there's a picture of us standing on the roof before they got there, with us holding sticks and chains and chucks. And it's a line of us standing on the edge of the roof of the administration building looking down. Somebody took a picture. Puffin is just, if in the wisdom, took that picture and made posters out of it. So while we're in the building doing whatever, he's outside selling posters. So I said to myself, I gotta fuck with this kid.
Yeah.
It's something about this kid I gotta fuck with.
Right.
Because we worried about taking over the building, and so was he, because he participated, but he found a way to monetize it.
Wow.
So his mindset was always on monetizing shit.
Yeah.
And not everybody's mindset was on that. And that was a lesson that I learned. Like, damn, he was multitasking.
Because
he participated in the takeover, but at the same time, he was like, yo, this would be hot. We could sell these posters, have this shit everywhere. And he's actually got the posters made up. You know, I helped donate it to the cause because I was making some money.
Sure.
And that's when I knew that him and I needed to hook up. And so we start throwing parties, and we became a black man in Puerto Rican production. Mm-hmm. We start throwing parties, and because he was from Mount Vernon, he knew Heavy D and I'll Be Sure and those guys. Because sure. I was from Brooklyn, I knew Kane and Rakim. And Ron was from Queens, so Ron knew Herbie, Salt and Pepper, Kid and Play. So it was a perfect combination for the three of us. So when those people came to town, we were the Big Dick Willies on campus. We were the guys that, oh my God, can you get us tickets to the Capitol Center? That's what they used to call it in Maryland. It used to be called the Capitol Center because, you know, Salt and Pepper's coming, or
right.
Kid and Play is coming, or Heavy D is coming, and I'll Be Sure is coming. And that's what we did. And we ended up making, you know, we didn't really connect in 87. It wasn't until 88, 89 that me and him really connected, and we took over the school. We started throwing the biggest parties. We created the first college night out off of campus, and that was still going on 20 years later. Thursday night, college night, me and Puff did that. And that's how we connected, and that we've been friends since. So you're talking about what? Was that almost 87, 97, 2007, 25 years.
Yeah.
We've been friends 25 years. More than half my life, because I'm 44.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible. You mentioned Ron, obviously your partner in TKO and,
right.
and in party promotion.
And in life.
And yeah.
Yeah, right. That's my boy.
We yeah.
Being.
Yeah.
You're not like, my partner like that. I mean, like, right.
I wanted to ask you about that, because you guys rhyme so well together on that first record, on like the TKO and tune. You're throwing lines back and forth and kind right. of finishing each other as ideas right. and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I wrote that.
Oh, you wrote the whole thing?
Well, I wrote pretty much most of the album.
Wow.
And Ron produced pretty much 90% of it. That was our thing. So a lot of you heard a lot of Ron's lyrics, but a lot of the lyrics were my lyrics.
Okay.
And a lot of Rich Byers, I mentioned him with that, was a black man. We had guys that were giving us ideas because of what they were doing. So How You Figure was actually Rich Byers' title. Wow. And I was like, okay, how you figure? Like, yeah, how do you figure? That's hot, Rich. I'll run with that. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. But, yeah, TK on.
So what makes you two work so well together, you and Ron?
I think because we're exact opposites, Ron didn't drink or smoke. You know what I'm saying? Ron was the, Ron got up at 6 in the morning. You know what I'm saying? I wasn't going to bed till 6 in the morning. You know, Ron was very technical, Dr. Dre-ish, if you want to call it. Like, everything had to be exact. You know, me, sloppy, whatever, it's cool. Let's just go. Let's just get out the way, you know? So I think that was it. And I was more to the streets. So in order for Ron, sometimes to bounce things, we bounce off of each other because I was the street guy. So, yo, D-Dot, is this beat hot? Nah, I can't rhyme off that. You know, streets ain't gonna like that. He change it, switch it. Okay, that's hot. And vice versa for me. I need to make sure that, you know, I ain't totally sloppy where I move myself out the game. So Ron would take things and fix it and make it presentable and make it so it was, quote unquote, sellable.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? So, yeah. So we were kind of the polar opposites and that attracted what we did.
That's awesome. Did that same dynamic stick through the Hitmen days?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely. Okay. Because most of our hit records were my ideas and his cleanup. Mm-hmm. Like, if you hear my version of Hypnotize and you hear the one that's out, you'll see why. Mm-hmm. You know, my kicks were like flanging off each other. And, you know, the bass line wasn't all the way because I'm a one finger guy. Do, 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 do. Ron would smooth it all out, make sure the drums, you know, he filters and he put all this shit. I'll do all that.
Right.
I know you see the video where Pac would be like, listen, let me just lay my lyrics down.
Right.
Yeah, and then you guys, that was Ron. That was me. Like, get me out of here. I want to go smoke. I want to go play. And Ron would stay there and make that shit sound like, wow.
Yeah.
You did that? Wow, more power to you.
Yeah.
You know, so that was our dynamic. Yeah.
Awesome. So what are your earliest memories of hip hop? And I ask this because there's this moment on TKO and where you sort of go into like a little tribute to a Cold Crush routine.
Right.
All that kind of stuff. And that got me thinking about like old school, like pre-Rapper's Delight hip-hop.
Right.
Maybe what your relationship was to that.
My very first experience, which I didn't know was hip-hop at the time, was a DJ by the name of Grandmaster Flowers. Have you heard of Grandmaster Flowers?
I haven't.
Okay. If you Google Grandmaster Flowers, he is probably the... I don't want to say... Let me say this first to preface that. Ron and his partner and I, and a couple of people, well, Ron Maney and his partner, created a documentary called The Founding Fathers. Because Ron is from Queens and I'm from Brooklyn. We don't consider Kool Herc and Africa Bambaataz the originators of hip-hop. Not even close, if you ask me. Because Grandmaster Flowers was the original Funkmaster Flex, the original DJ. Before there was even mixers. He DJed for James Brown in 1969 at Yankee Stadium. He was one of the first DJs to DJ in parks in Brooklyn, all around. He was one of the first DJs to get paid to DJ events for the urban space. And this is 1960s. I was born in 68. So my first experience was in Bedford-Stuyvesant. I was probably 7 years old. And my father, who was at the time an alcoholic, you know, addict, whatever, he used to take me everywhere with him. And I went to a park and I got to see Grandmaster Flowers. And I got to see somebody not yes, yes, y'all, to the beat, y'all, none of that stuff. It was more like, you know, party over here. Don't forget to pay your waitresses, do whatever. The first time I actually saw a DJ and a guy work in tandem with each other. Mm-hmm. Right. We're talking about maybe 1974, 75. Fast forward, my cousins who were from the Bronx, my Spanish side, would come to Brooklyn for things like that, and they would have these cassettes of these guys from the Bronx. Mm-hmm. And it was the Fantastic Five, the Fantastic Four, when they became later, called Crush Brothers, and all these guys, 77, 76, Busy B.
Yeah.
And they were talking over instrumentals. Mind you, the mixer, I don't even think what year the mixer was created in 1970. This is the era when DJs would have to drop a needle on the spot of the break part.
Right.
Because there was no fader.
Yeah.
And there was no headphones for you to sit there and do that. That was created as a result of Flowers and these DJs showing you that there was a need for it. Mm-hmm. Because we're going back and forth with two turntables, trying to drop a needle on a record, literally picking it up and finding a spot. So if you're in clubs, I'm sure you've been to clubs and you hear the DJ and the blend is not going right.
Yeah.
That's what it was in the 60s, in the early 70s. The mixes weren't right.
Yeah.
And that was my first experience. And it wasn't until later on that it got this title. And we were like, really? We've seen this already. And then you see a guy like Kool Herc, who I've never in my life seen actually DJ any group or anybody. And me personally, they credit him for whatever he did. But an Africa Bambaataa to Brooklyn cats and Queens cats was like, the music was cool, but these dudes look like Parliament Funkadelic. So that's why when you see Cold Crush, Run DMC, and these guys, they really look more like the everyday kid from New York than African Bambaataa and Melly Mel and these guys. These guys have feathers coming out their hair, leather pants with tight boots. We're sitting back like, music is cool, but we can't do that. So when you saw Run DMC, it was all the way to the right. They had on plain white and a hat and a jacket. Oh, that's us.
Yeah.
That's how we look. So my first experience, my first concert was seeing Rapper's Delight at Brooklyn College. My mother took me because by 79, I'm all in now.
Right.
I'm 11 years old. I done got all these tapes that my cousin let me copy. I'm the guy on the block in Brooklyn that nobody else got these but me. So you want to hear the Cold Crush at Red Parrot 1982? I got it. You want to hear Fantastic Four battling these guys? I got it. I had it all.
Wow.
And I still have them to this day. Saved them. They all cataloged. I got them. Ron got his too. I kept them because these were historic. So yes, I told you, Grandmaster Caz, the Cold Crush Brothers, when I heard them singing, rapping, taking old songs and making new routines out of them, I was like, holy shit, these guys are incredible. So what they did was they took DJ Hollywood's concept and all these guys earlier, way before them, and turned it into hip-hop and rappers. And that was my first experience. So when you get a chance, you need to research Grandmaster Flowers.
Definitely.
Because that's where Grandmaster Flash got his name from.
Huh?
He gave it to Flash. So Grandmaster Flash is not the original Grandmaster. Grandmaster Flowers from Brooklyn is. And when you learn more about this, you realize that hip-hop has been running for at least 10 years before 1979. Maybe 8.
Wow. So yeah, it's very interesting. I actually just talked the other day to someone who I guess is in some ways a founding father of hip-hop, Abi Odun Oyewole from The Last Poets.
Right. Well, and he is the original rapper.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because it's crazy listening to him because you're like, oh, you're rhyming over drum beats, right? And talking about some of the same stuff that we associate with rap, but obviously rap, you know, no one had thought to name this a genre. It was just some stuff some poets were doing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yes. So the Last Poets were probably the very first rappers we ever experienced. But then again, if I really sat here and did your history,
right,
I could take you back to the 20s and let you hear a rapper rapping over an instrumental beat. And
like Cab Calloway or something? No?
No, not Cab Calloway. Cab Calloway was singing and what they call it, scatting?
Right.
Scatting, yes. No. I'll show you after we get off.
Yeah, please.
Yeah,
please.
Yeah.
Wow, real history lesson.
We'll be right back with our conversation with Derek Angeletti. You're listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. If you're curious about any of the songs mentioned on this show, you can find lyrics, music, and annotations on rapgenius.com. You can also see Derek's verified Rap Genius account, including notes where he talks about his role in 50 Cent's controversial song, How to Rob, at rapgenius.com/D.Angeletti. That's A-N-G-E-L-E-T-T-I-E. Welcome back to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, same old Sean. We began the second half of our interview with the amazing producer and rapper Derek D.Angeletti by talking about the impact that new jack swing pioneer Teddy Riley had on his work.
You've talked about how Teddy Riley was a big influence on you. I saw an interview you did a couple of years ago where you mentioned him in your top, you know, five.
Yes,
can you talk a little bit about New Jack Swing and how its sound influenced you? And I ask this because I feel like that sound, just because it's comparatively new, it's newer than like disco or something.
Right.
So it doesn't get the respect that other, you know, older pop music forms get to me.
Right. Well, I mean, this is a guy who didn't get a lot of credit for doing hip-hop records when he was actually doing a lot of those hip-hop records. And to be able to be a guy who actually had a sound that two or three different genres embraced simultaneously was incredible to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because you had guys rapping over his beats and you had people singing over his beats at the same time.
Yeah.
Not knowing that this is the same guy doing this music. He actually was influential with Dougie Fresh and Slick Rick. He actually produced the show. If you read the credits for the show, you see Teddy Riley's name on it. Uh-huh. So this guy has been doing this a very long time. So somebody like Larry Smith, for example, you know, who did all the Run DMC and Beastie Boys and LL Cool J stuff, is a guy who didn't get credit for changing the way we listening to these beats. The Lindrums and all these things, you know, Rock the Bells and things like that.
Yeah.
Those shits was incredible music making. See, the 70s guys, that was still a live band era. Disco was fading. So all they were doing was taking live band musicians and replaying the songs.
Right.
So Rapper's Delight was a replay of Good Times.
Right. It was just the Sugar Hill Band, Doug Wimbish and all those guys.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, fast forward, here goes some guys that are now taking those same elements with no live guys. They're taking them from out of a machine and switching it. So now the texture of it is a little different. The pitch may have changed. The notes may have changed. And then we getting all these sound effects like, wham! Ka-cha-ka-cha! Whip! And they're getting incorporated into a rhythm. So you may be doing a boom-bam-boom-wham! Boom. And this is a guy hitting a button, creating what somebody would have did this to. A normal on a guitar was now. Yeah. That was incredible to me. And Teddy Riley was one of the pioneers of that. And not only was he a pioneer, it was hit records after hit record after hit record.
Yeah.
So I'm like, shit, not only is he creative, but he's making fucking hits too. So yeah, he was one of my top guys. And he, you know, in power to the little guys, because he was a little guy, too short. So I'm, you know, I'm all the little guys under 6 feet, man. We got to stay together. You know what I'm saying? That's how I looked at it. Yeah.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. Jumping ahead a little bit, you did one of my all-time favorite Jay-Z records.
Really?
And I have to say, and I don't know if you know this, it's still the only song from Volume 1 that he performs live. I saw him twice last week, and he still performs it. He opens the show with it.
The show with it, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know
that.
Can
you talk a little bit about Where I'm From? Can you talk a little about the creation of it? And what did you think when you heard the concept lyrically that he brought to that music?
Wow. That record was Jay-Z, after he heard Life After Death. He did not leave Daddy's house until he got a Life After Death. And that wasn't the first beat I played him. I played him a few beats. And he was looking for something specific. Ron Lawrence had put a spin on it, because I don't know if you remember, that track was actually used by Biz Markie on a record called, I think it was A Guy Named Kim or A Girl Named Kim. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Same sample. So Ron kind of flipped it a little bit, and I said, well, because remember now, I'm still an MC. I needed to be MC-ish. I still needed to be. So I tweaked it a little bit, which what me and him do.
Yeah.
Played it for Jay. Actually played it for Dame first. And Dame was like, oh my God, Jay got to hear this. Jay got to hear this. Played it for Jay, and Jay said, yeah. Sauce Money was actually the one who came up with the concept of you should make this record about where you from. Source Money. So I guess he must have told that to Jay-Z. Because when me and Ron got to the studio, Jay-Z was like, yeah, okay, this is what I'm going to do. The problem that I had with the record, which, you know, which is probably what bonded me and Jay to this day, was, one, he wasn't really an ad-libs guy. Like I'm a very much voice equals notes, is what I learned from Gamble and Huff. So Puffy ended up mastering that concept, meaning any gap in a record can be filled in with something, whether it's an instrument, whether it's a and that was me and beginning of me explaining to Jay how important those things were. Not to say he didn't know it, but I stressed it. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't leave. And also the dynamic between me and Ron was I was the vocal guy. I was the guy that sat there because I was the MC, would coach you through it. Fuck that. Come out, rewrite it. I don't like that. You got to change that. Try it again. Yeah. You know, I'm that guy.
Yeah.
So I did that with Jay. And he was still in his fast rapping phase, if you remember.
I remember, yeah, of course. I remember his pretty first album stuff. Yeah.
Right. So I was heavy on him about slowing it down. Like every couple of bars, you know, we put the can in the work and run. I mean, put the work in the can and run. That was his, you know, Drake is doing that now. Like, if you think about what Drake does, he says the long word and pauses. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's Jay-Z 10 years ago, some years ago. You know, run, like, don't be afraid to put yourself in the record. Everything don't have to be so hard and so, don't be afraid to personality some of this shit. Because that's going to separate you from the men from the boys. If you can actually laugh at yourself and listen to your lyrics and be like, you know what, I can't emphasize this a little more. Put a little bit more oomph into this, and that's where, you know, that's how the record came out the way it is. And that's why to this day, even when he listed on one album, I think he had to list his top 10 or 15 songs of all time, Where I'm From was one of them. Because it's just one of those records where that's one of the, I ain't gonna say perfectly painted, but that's a very nice painted picture.
Yeah.
You see it clearly. Everything, it's like, I can see it as he's saying it. And that's what always my goal was as a producer, to make sure you can see it as you're hearing it.
Yeah.
If you don't see it as you're hearing it, it's pretty much not going to work.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
You know? It's so interesting you say that about the ad-libs, because, yeah, I think Volume 1 is where you first start to hear, you know, his sort of famous, you know, uhs and ah-ahs and that kind of stuff.
And that's just me stressing it. I don't take credit for being the one that introduced him to it, because he was definitely doing ad-libs, but I stressed it. Yeah. Because, you know, one, B.I.G. was a master at that, but two, I was a master at that. I was a master at making sure that the track was full, and it didn't have to be full of instruments, but your voice is an instrument. So if you can add a that keeps, and I'm a dancer, so I don't mean like one of those scuba scrap dancers, but I like to dance. I'm a dancer.
Yeah.
So that is what helps you move, when you can hear somebody melodically going through something and they don't miss a beat, even if everything ain't word, ooh, ah, yeah. So yeah, that's how we did that.
Excellent. One other famous record you've done, obviously, is Hypnotize. When I was reading you talk about it, it seemed like you were saying Biggie came up with the hook almost instantly. Is like he heard the beat and then he had the, you know, Biggie, can't you see?
I don't know.
Okay.
What I'm saying is, when I walked in the room, from what happened was, we went to Trinidad on a famous trip, the Hitmen, to make beats.
Right.
For Puff. Puff had gave us this big speech about he wanted to take over the airwaves, he wanted to take over the music business, and he felt like the best thing for us to do is go have a retreat, a producer retreat.
Yeah.
So he packed up all of us and we went to Trinidad. When we came back, Puffy had already played the beat for Biggie, so I didn't even get to play it for him. So when I walked into the room, this was my first time seeing him since we came back from Trinidad, and he had the biggest, oh my God, on his face. He already had the beat from Puff, because Puff was excited about it.
Yeah.
And when I walked in the room, that's where probably where you got it from. Instantaneously, he said, so just imagine this big man sitting in a chair. I walk in the door, because the door was over there. He's bouncing to the beat. Oh, yo, come here. You got to hear this. Sat me down and instantly said, Biggie, can't you see? And I'm like, and that's when the StarTAC phones was out. Remember StarTAC?
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, that's cool. I got it. Walked out the room. Wow! shit, it's gonna be here. That called everybody. Yo, I'm a Beatles star. How you don't understand what's going on? Because for him to tell me that was big, for because you didn't hear Big's lyrics most of the time until he went in that room.
Wow.
Because everything was up here. And for him to do that for me meant that it was serious. And after he finished, he said, oh yeah, by the way, this is my first single. You did not just say that to me. Out of all the shit we got that I'm A&R and I know we have, that's the first single? Okay, great, thanks. And I went outside and yelled and screamed and jumped out and did everything I could. But no, he didn't come up with instantaneously. But that, my first seeing him after coming back from Trinidad, it almost seemed like as soon as he saw me, come here, I got this lyric for you.
Yeah.
But he already had the beat maybe a day or two before I saw him.
How did he work?
Like, weed, really? Weed, liquor, and the beat. That's it. It could be a million people in the studio, and this man was 300-something pounds, and all he did was sit there. And remember, he had asthma, too. I don't know if people remember that. Right. Big had asthma. So he'd be sitting there like, all right, I'm ready. And that's it. And go right in the booth, and maybe two takes, and he was done. And if he left the booth, he wasn't getting him back in there. So I have a record I did called Live at the Barbecue not too long ago where you hear Biggie at the beginning say, call Derek in here. Because if he was in that booth and I wasn't there, he would sit there until I came in. Because once he walked out, he was leaving, Tupac style. He was done. He ain't going to have me going back in and out, you know, while I'm in here, get me. And you know what I'm saying? So,
including all the doublings and ad-libs and all that.
Sometimes, you know, I mean, what I mean by that is, if his, you know, for him, it was about the moment. Him feeling the moment. Mm-hmm. So if he has to now come back out and he's not feeling the vibe no more, it's going to be hard for him to punch in 7 lines or 6 lines that give that same energy and give that same thing.
Sure.
So he would rather do it while he's feeling the moment. Mm-hmm. But if we needed him to come back in and clean up something, like, yo, babe, we got to do clean versions, you know, and whatever, he would go do it.
Sure.
But yeah, that was his style.
Sure. I mean, you've worked with some really crazy, I mean, MCs are maybe among the best who ever did it, obviously. Yeah, Jay and
there's the top 25. I probably work with 20 of them.
Yeah. What it, as you know, someone who's a you know, vocal coach, producer, like you've been, when you're working with people who are that, you know, top tier, What's it like to coaching someone like that, who most people would think, oh, you don't need to coach an Eminem, he already knows exactly what he's doing?
Well, I get it, but at the time they weren't top tier.
Yeah.
So I didn't look at him like I was coaching Michael Jordan at the time. It wasn't until now that I realized that was Michael Jordan, Larry Bird, you know, fucking, you know, Dr. J and Shaquille O'Neal. Now they are who they are, but back then he was nice, but he was still a mold. It was still that Life After Death album could have not been what it was, because we still had to teach him to not, you know, if you listen to Ready to Die, he was yelling a lot. It was, everything was high pitch, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You know, party and bullshit, and his vocals are up here. Then if you go listen to Life After Death, we kind of said, let's tone it down a little bit, ladies, my Mercedes, hold four in the back, two if you're fat. Now it's a little bit more relaxed, more confident. So, yeah. So I still was in awe, but it wasn't like, oh, my God, let me not offend Michael Jordan. Sure. Let me not offend Kareem. You know, it wasn't that. You know, it wasn't that for me yet. It was still like, okay, nah, you got to do it this way, fam. I mean, I know you're good, but, you know, let's fix this shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Eminem the same way. When I first, Busta introduced me to Eminem, by the way.
Yeah.
But when I first Eminem, I was like, okay, he's nice, but when we get in the studio, he still could use a little bit of, now do that again. Take a breath there. You might want to take that word out because that's messing up your, they still have to get that. Yeah. Even to this day, I guarantee you, somebody's in there telling Eminem, you know, punch that. You know, you were sick or it didn't match the first line or whatever. You know, there's no way you're just in there just like, you know, everybody leave the room, I got it from here, I'm good.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Do you feel like that role, the role of a producer in that sense, someone to guide the artist and challenge the artist, is disappearing?
Missing. Yeah, it's missing. Definitely. That's why we're hearing the music we're hearing. Because now you have a guy sitting in his basement and doing the beat and writing the lyrics and putting it out. No filter, no listening session,
mm-hmm.
no guideline. When we made Biggie's album was patterned after a book. We were trying to make The Art of War. We were trying to make Roots. We were trying to make, you know, a epic saga.
Yeah.
You know, we actually listened to the NWA album. Mary J. Blige's 411 album. We were patterning his album after, you know, chapters of books. Like, we want you to be entertained. So yeah, that's how at least I was taught to make albums from Mr. Gamble and Mr. Huff.
Right.
That was my mentors in music.
Yeah, I believe so. The Philly Soul thing was really big for you.
Really big, because our manager at the time, Hawk Islam, was connected to them. So we actually recorded Two Kings and a Cypher album in DC and at 309.
Wow.
And so we had the privilege of meeting and working with Mr. Gamble and Mr. Huff, and them giving us jewels that I use to this day. Like, Mr. Gamble used to always tell us, the only way you're going to keep making hit records is to stay in the studio. If you don't stay in the studio, you can go in every 3 months and think your dick is that big that you can just go in and just go in and make a hit record in 2 days and walk out. Yeah, right. Yeah. You have to stay in there. And he told us that back in 1989. You know?
Incredible. I
like if you have responses like that.
Well, those guys are yeah. I mean, the kings, you know, it's like talking to Berry Gordy or something, you know.
It was a blessing to have that, and yeah. I still speak to his kids to this day.
Wow.
Mr. Gamble's kid.
Nice. Yeah. I wanted to ask you something, and you don't have to talk about it if you don't want to.
Okay.
I don't want to go into the details of the Washington thing at all.
What's that?
But the assault thing.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I don't want to go into details of that. It's not important to me. I was curious about one thing about it, though. Before that happened, you were known in hip-hop, but hip-hop producers generally aren't known to a mass audience. Their names aren't known. Their faces aren't known.
Right.
What was it like to suddenly get that kind of recognition, to suddenly be on the news, to end up as a Saturday Night Live punchline, like, overnight?
A lot of people never saw that, the Saturday Night Live punchline.
Well, I heard you talk about it in an interview, and you remembered the joke word for word.
Yeah, it
so
was
obviously
crazy.
Something about that time stuck with you.
Exactly that. I was a Puffy protege. I was a guy who people knew, but producers weren't supposed to be the front guys.
Yeah.
That just wasn't what it was supposed to be. You had somebody like Teddy Riley who, you know, worked his way to become who he was, and Puffy wanted to, and Jermaine Dupri wanted to be the guys to help change that mold. That's why Puffy talked on all the records and did what he did.
Right.
So for me to have that exposure now, it was like, wow. But it was for the wrong thing. It wasn't for my accomplishments is
right.
What threw me off. It wasn't because I just produced many hit records and I'm that guy. It was because magazine editors are off limits. Really? He lost me $500,000. From where I'm from, that don't come every day. I had a $500,000 Feli deal on tape. Because Brooklyn, Feli, we went together.
Yeah.
But they did not want me to let people know that I was the mad rapper. They wanted D-Dot. So the minute you put those two together, I'm at zero again. Gee, thanks, Mr. Washington. And that's what happened.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, yeah, but it felt good. Saturday Night Live was really, you know, I would have rather been on it, hosting or something, but to be a punchline in it means you were pop culture. You were a member of pop culture at that mm-hmm. time. Saturday Night Live is like the epitome of being mm-hmm. pop culture.
Yeah.
You make it on there, you made it everywhere.
Did that help you understand in some ways someone like Puff or Jay a little better and what they go through?
A little bit, but I bought that on myself, though. You know
right.
what I mean? It wasn't accolades. A lot of things that happened with them, you know, they get because they are their own worst enemy. And so, in that particular instance, I was my own worst enemy, and that's why. But
right.
it still worked to my benefit because it adds on to the lore of D-Dot, because now I'm this gangster in the music business. Now, you know, be careful. When D-Dot's coming in the room, I'm like, yeah. And I got a last name, Angeletti. So now you're thinking I'm mafioso at the same time. You know what I'm saying? You got this
right.
black guy walking in, last name Angeletti, he's punching editors, and you go, oh my God, let's not have him in here long, please, at all.
Would have beefed up security
right,
if I
right,
remember
right,
here. I don't know.
Right. Exactly.
Nice. So what's happening now with D-Dog, Crazy Cat, Mad Rapper, Mad Producer, all of it? What's happening now?
Mad Rapper is about to drop Still Mad, which is the final album in the saga of this whole thing, and it's really because of the industry. So I'm dropping Still Mad. Obviously, I have the newer cats, Nicki Minaj. I got Meek Mill. I got, you know,
mm-hmm.
I have to keep up with the times.
Sure.
Freeway, Fred DeGarson, as you know. So I'm doing that. I started a company years ago because once again, I had Crazy Cat the label. I managed Mary J. Blige. I had Kanye. So my Rolodex really built up. I have a nice Rolodex. So I started a company about 7 years ago called Connect the Dots. Because so many people would call me and say, can you listen to my demo, please? Can you help my son? Can you? My daughter really wants to. Can you? So, man, I could probably make $100 a pop off of this here. I could probably. So I monetized it.
Yeah.
Became a consultant to a lot of people and a lot of things. Even to this day. Well, I wouldn't say to this day, but even up to last train to Paris, I think it was, mm-hmm. before that Puff. Harv and Puff and those guys would always end up inviting me over to come throw my ear. Because the one thing that I've been credited for in the music business was my ears. And my attractiveness to something new before anybody else got to it. Nobody mm-hmm. knew who 50 Cent was until I got to him.
Yeah.
Nobody knew who Kanye was until I got to him. Eminem until I helped, you know, bring light that these guys are cool. You might want to get up on it.
Yeah.
So that's always been my claim to fame. You know, being able to get with the new batch of guys before anybody else got with them. Whether they went on and become success without me is a whole nother issue. But the fact is that I was with them from the beginning.
Yeah.
And they know it. The people know it. And that's kind of good for me. So with Connect the Dots, I have Stevie J, who's a part of Love & Hip Hop, who was also a multi-platinum Grammy Award winning producer. He's now a reality star. So he has his new album coming soon because of all his fame. So he's going to drop an album. And so I'm helping to manage his situation. Over the years, because of money I made, I own a lot of property. I didn't really go out and get the jewelry and stuff like that. I've been married 14 years. I got four daughters. So I ended up buying brownstones in Bed-Stuy and Philadelphia and Queens. So right now, with all this stuff going on downtown Brooklyn, I'm perfect. I got two brownstones down there being rented out and things like that. So that's another reason why I come to New York, to collect that rent. You know what I'm saying? Nice. Hi, it's me. So we do that. And that's pretty much, you know, music-wise, I was telling Tommy that I'm not in love with the new rappers today because the effort is not there. And the expansion of the brain and the mind is not there. You know, when I look at an artist, and I hate to use him as an example all the time, but I have to because he's considered one of the best. When I think about Big and I think about the 10 crack commandments, and I think about this drugs, he's talking about drugs. He is. But the way mm-hmm. he's talking about drugs
yeah.
is what you have to look at. Most people be like, I sell weight, I get 100,000, whatever, and that's that. This guy gave you rules, and the rules applied to your mother, your father. It applied to everybody. It applied to life.
Yeah.
So, very creative to me. When Nas did the 22s, you know, with the 22s and the gun, when he made himself a gun.
Yeah.
Those are the guys that separate themselves. That's the separation factor. Those are the guys that separate themselves because they put in actual thought mm-hmm. into this whole thing of ours. Obviously, Jay, the Slick Ricks.
Yeah.
So when I look at this thing of ours and I look at these new guys who are not made men yet, they're not fucking it up because it's always expansion. But for guys like me, I'm considered a dinosaur because there's no need for a guy like me with you anymore. The beats all sound the same. And there's no real content besides sex, drugs, and rock and roll. And after that, there is nothing else to do. You don't have to teach on every record, but so I'm not really a fan. But I do know, I feel like when I was coming up, there was a thing we called the Daisy Age. Remember that age?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like we're in a similar time right now, where out of this is going to come
mm-hmm.
a Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah.
Another Nas. You know, like, no disrespect to these guys, but the Odd Future guys are just not my cup of tea. I like Frank Ocean, but, you know, when you start doing what Ozzy Osbourne is doing, and you start doing that, you're throwing me to the side. You definitely don't need me now. So, not to say that they're not good for hip-hop, they're just not good for D-Dot's hip-hop, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying, what I do. But, you know, I'm looking for the next EPMD. If you notice, we haven't had a duo in mm-hmm. maybe mm-hmm. 20 years
yeah. that
have been hot since Dos Effects, maybe a real duo. I mean, Outkast, they've, you know, they're Hall of Fame, so remove Outkast. But after that, who has been the two guys, you know, in our era coming up, we two guys all the time. We had them all everywhere. You know, mm-hmm. it was two guys, me and Ron, and EPMD, Dos FX, Drez, and the other guy, and yeah. Tribe Called Quest. And,
yeah.
So mm-hmm. now there's none. It's every man for himself. Everybody's a soloist, and you have to be below Virginia to win, or below DC.
Right.
You know, so somebody like Wale, I like him. But is he going to be top 20 on anybody's list? Probably only 17-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, as one final thing, I was hoping we could get the Mad Rapper to come on in and maybe yeah. give us a little shout out and you know his thoughts on the game and all that kind of stuff real quick.
That's no problem.
Yeah.
That's absolutely no problem. We have to figure out. What would the Mad Rapper say about today?
Well, his brother would probably say, come on, man, speed it up. We got to get the fuck out of here, man. You're taking a long time.
And my response would be, fuck you, man. Like, you know what I'm saying? Hip-hop is whack. Mad Rapper would probably say what? What would I probably say? because the new hate that I have now is more like, it would be more like, you know what I'm saying? Like, Waka Flacka, Flacka Wacka. You know, I'd make fun of the names. I would be like, Young Jeezy, he's 47. I mean, when is he going to be, you know, just Jeezy? It's like, you know what I mean? Everybody is young. Everybody is either, you know, like, I would get on shit like that. You know what I'm saying? You know, guy's older than me, Young Jeezy. You know what I'm saying? Or Young Hove. Like, get the fuck out of here, Young Hove. Like, you know what I'm saying? Or like... You know, I would go in on shit like that. I would go in on shit like, you know, Wiz Khalifa, you know, like that. If that's not Snoop Dogg reincarnated, I don't know who is. You know, so yeah. I would Mad Rapper would say something about Wiz Khalifa, Waka Flacka, or you know the name, or what's the boy from down south that I can't stand. Yeah, that guy right there,
Lil Jon.
Yeah, Lil Jon.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would go in on somebody, even though he's not, you know, he's not a young guy. I would just go in on shit like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys, excuse me. Sometimes, Mad Rap, I need a little thought.
No, definitely. We look forward to hearing his next
Still Mad
full album.
Yeah,
Still Mad.
Still Mad. Yeah, Still Mad. And it's just about demand. You know, people, yo, we need you to hate on this. Why is this motherfucker rapping? Why is this guy, like, I don't know if y'all watched the BET Awards, mm-hmm. but the show opened up with Wiz Khalifa with his hit record, and he's lip-syncing. Next artist that comes on is Meek Mills, which shocked me. He's lip-syncing. Mm-hmm. Hurt to my heart.
Yeah.
Because I actually like him. I think he's nice. The first person that didn't rap on the record was Kendrick Lamar.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Meanwhile, nobody knows who the fuck he is.
I know.
And he's doing what these guys should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
And if anybody should be rapping over his track, it's a new guy because you're so nervous about fucking up and embarrassing yourself. Mm-hmm. But the old guys are even more worried about that.
Right.
So he rapped over the instrumental. Crystal clear, heard it. So that's what Still Mad is about. I thought I told you guys how to fix this 10, 15 years ago. And you still haven't. So now I have to show you again how to fix this.
It's like they took the hating part and ignored the message.
Right, 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 right. You forgot what I was trying to say.
Yeah.
I wasn't really hating. I was, but I was really on some cleanup. Let's clean this shit up a little bit, and you haven't listened. So, you know, I see people like Ghostface and Sheik Looch doing albums together now, which is cool. The audience is probably really small for that. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. But... they're trying to keep hope alive. And all we could do is, you know, Styles P is making a new album. We haven't heard a new Lox album in, what, 10 years, maybe?
Yeah, a long
like,
time.
Ridiculous. Yeah. Like, how hard could that be to put 12 songs together with three guys? Can't be that hard. Yeah. Absolutely not. It takes Nas every 3-4 years to make his album. Still to this day, he will not get the same accolades that fucking Jay-Z and Kanye got for their album. Mm-hmm. Even though Nas' album was probably one of the best, maybe, album he did in a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Came and went.
Yeah.
Came and went. Meanwhile, we're listening to, you know, who are we listening to now? That's absolutely insane. Chief Keith. Chief Keith. Signed off of one deal, 7 figures. How you figure?
Crazy. And on that note, we'll close with that. Thank you so much, Derek, for stopping by Outside the Lines. It was really amazing to get your perspective on so much stuff. We really appreciate it.
And I'm very, I'm very historic guy when it comes to telling you some things that you might not know. So
yeah.
Anytime. I like it. I will admit, though, it's probably taking me a long time because I hate talking about the whole shit.
Yeah.
I've been one of them, I've turned down Vibe interviews every time. Biggie, we celebrated the 15th anniversary. You won't get to talk to me.
Yeah.
Well, we got Double XL. The 15th year Mace's album coming out. I get it, but I'm still young in my mind.
Yeah.
I don't have to deal with the Chief Keefs of the world, but there's so much more music to be made that I can't keep going backwards. But this is different because this was, for one, the questions were a lot more unique than the average person. But two, it kind of covered my career.
Yeah.
As opposed to someone else's career.
Mm-hmm. That's what we, we have you in the room, so right. That's why we try to focus on.
And most of the time, I'm always talking about somebody else's career. Meanwhile, my shit is nothing to sneeze at. So if I'm going to do it, I'd rather do it in this form.
Yeah.
Where I can still talk about the yesterday, the today, and the tomorrow.
You've been listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Rap Genius is dedicated to decoding, annotating, and analyzing hip-hop lyrics. We'll be taking a week off to revamp the show, but we'll return in 2 weeks with a whole new parade of fantastic guests. In the meantime, you can visit our incredible archive of interviews at iTunes or rapgenius.libsyn.com. That's Libsyn. Outside the Lines with Rap Genius is hosted and written by Sean Sotero, a.k.a. Same Old Sean. To make sure you never miss an episode of the show, please subscribe to this podcast on iTunes. You can reach me with your thoughts about Outside the Lines via Twitter. I'm at Same Old Sean, that's S-H-A-W-N. This show was recorded and engineered by Brian Penny at the beautiful 3Egg Studios in Brooklyn, New York. Our intern is Sunny Kahara. Intro and outro music by Psionic. Interlude music by Sir Loin. I'm your host, Same Old Sean, and I'll see you in 2 weeks on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius.